طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we feature a conversation between Phil Weiss, co-founder and driving force behind the Mondo Weiss News Service, and Leah Tarachansky, an Israeli filmmaker and the former Israel-Palestine correspondent for the Real News Network, and an anti-Zionist pro-Palestinian activist. She currently resides in Toronto. This Canadian broadcast we feature today was sponsored by the Ontario Focused Intervention Partnership. We jump right into the conversation following the introductions.
I'm at home. Okay. So, Phil, let me just start off. First, welcome again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you here. Start off, just tell us a little bit about your story from being a very serious kind of mainstream Jewish journalist to having your own kind of radical publication, now defining yourself as anti-Zionist. How did that happen? Give us a little bit of, fill us in a little bit.
Sure. I I'm 65, so I've had a long career. When you say I was a serious mainstream journalist, I certainly was involved with a lot of mainstream publications. I did a lot of celebrity journalism and other things. I feel that my serious work began I'm a late bloomer, began in 2002 when the United States prepared to invade Iraq. And that's when I realized I saw a lot of my friends in the journalism business. I've been fairly successful, even though I don't think the work was that serious. As I say, it was mostly glossy celebrity profiles, other kind of feature journalist. I was a feature journalist. So I saw a lot of my colleagues who were supporting this awful war. Anyone knew that this was an awful war. You didn't have to have any expertise to know that that war was an awful war, an awful idea. And so I just decided to use all what professional and personal capital I could to oppose that war. And that ultimately led to my starting a blog, and my editor named it. I am an egomaniac. I can't be shy about that, but I wouldn't have named it after myself. My editor named it after me, and it was going to be this personal blog. And it quickly developed in 2006, into this consideration of Zionism as a Jew, who's very uncomfortable with Zionism. And I think I met Leah on probably my second or third visit to Israel and Palestine in 08 or 09. And so I've been at this work now for 15 years. It's very different from my previous work in the mainstream media. It's journalism, but it's also advocacy. I am a cause-oriented person that suits my personality. And I'm blessed to be involved with, I'm blessed to have met a lot of really interesting and serious people, including Leah, who are engaged by this question. This is a very difficult question, obviously. And I look forward to seeing Yusuf and John Allen on your show in months to come. Very serious question, extremely perplexing, not that complicated. And for a Jew, there's a very important role to play. And happily, the site that I'm involved with has now evolved past my very navel-gazing concerns about being a Jewish anti-Zionist. It's gotten into a more appropriate consideration of just human rights, the simple question of human rights in Palestine and in Israel. So I hope that answers your question, Peter, but I could go on about myself forever. So I'm sorry if I rambled.
No, that was terrific. And Leah, feel free. I mean, you and Leah have a history going back that I'm only vaguely aware of. So Leah, jump in and pump Phil with questions.
Well, I should just say Leah was one of my guides, and and of course she's done great work herself. I don't know if you've seen her documentary. It came out a few years ago, really about
By the Side of the Road.
Yes, about Israeli consciousness and lack of understanding of what had been perpetrated there.
Well, I was blessed too to have Leah as my guide when she took me down to Beersheba and traveled a bit around the Negev, and that was a great introduction to me. I was a bit aware of what had happened, what was going on in the West Bank. I was totally ignorant about 48 Palestine. So this was a big help to me as well.
This actually leads me to my first question for Phil, which was, I've only worked in the U.S. for 1 year as a journalist, but I've started covering Israel and Palestine since 2006, and I've been based there for most of my life. And I think that just like you, I started working for an independent news network, the Real News Network, because I saw that there was a huge gap between what was being reported in the West and what was going on the ground in Israel and Palestine. Now, I've only ever really covered Israel-Palestine as a journalist, so I don't know if this is the case for all the different foreign kind of stories that are reported in the American domestic press. But I guess my first question to you is, why was there and continues to be a need for Manda Weiss, and how do you understand this enormous, canyon-sized gap between what is going on in the ground in Israel and Palestine, and not just in terms of the occupied territories, but also in Israel, and how it is reported on in the West and specifically in America?
Thanks, Leah. It's a very big question, obviously, and it's sort of the central question. So let me take it apart a little bit and try to address it in a couple of parts. First of all, as to whether this happens in other aspects of foreign policy or American conduct, American behavior in the world, I imagine it does, but I'm a tunnel vision kind of person. And so I can only talk about my beat. And so with respect to what this gap that exists in the American understanding of what is going on there and what the reality is, and the necessity for the work that I do. I'm not trying to put on airs here. I have long hoped that I would become obsolete, that, I'm sure, Leah, you've had similar feelings. We hope that the day will come when certain attitudes are so reflected in mainstream reporting that we are regarded as pioneers who help bring this awareness to a wider audience. And then we're no longer necessary. We were the pioneers, as I say. I think that day will come. But to address your point, why is this? Or how big is that canyon and why does it exist? I think the why is a very hard question. Today, Tony Blinken, who is Biden's nominee to be Secretary of State, was talking to the Senate about he's seeking confirmation. He will get confirmation as Secretary of State. And all the questions that came up about Israel and Palestine were totally divorced from the reality. They were all about preserving a Jewish state through a two-state solution. That was the mantra that Blinken said. We want to preserve a Jewish democratic state by having a two-state solution. Now, anyone who has been over there understands that there isn't going to be a two-state solution. The possibility is so remote. It's like, as a friend said, the likelihood that you're going to fly to Mars tomorrow. I mean, it just, you have that one state, one government that controls the entire territory, which is not that large a country, and that has thoroughly taken its population and moved it into the occupied territories, 700,000 of its citizens in or so in the occupied territories, separate laws, but total infiltration of that other territory. The idea of partition, which began with a 50-50 swap, roughly, I mean, actually 56% for the quote-unquote Jewish state. Now that Jewish state has 78% plus, closer to 85% of the actual territory. So the idea of partition is very difficult to even contemplate, and yet American politicians swear by it. And Tony Blinken today was the idealistic position, was supporting a two-state solution. And so
And the journalists?
Oh, you mean how the journalists imbibe this too, and mainstream journalists will reflect this too and will say, oh, he's for a two-state solution. Good liberals in America are for a two-state solution. I think that the awareness is beginning to break in. I mean, I think that everyone on this who's pictured in this call right now are people who have wrestled with this reality. And that reality is beginning to break in America, but it's beginning to break in at the fringes. And I don't know, Leah, what you've observed, but certainly 10 years ago, it would have been hard to imagine congresspeople like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who are espousing BDS, who are talking about one state that where people are talking about the struggle for equal rights, even if they're not for one state as such. And so that reality, we didn't think that they would be in Congress. They're in Congress now, and they're inside the Democratic Party. So this awareness is beginning to, it's increasing, but we have a long way to go.
So we hear Leah?
I just wanted to follow up.
Okay, sure. I got something to follow up to. You go ahead.
Iman, I sent you a graph, and, you know, I think one of the biggest problems with the way that we're talking about it is that we are focusing on, that's actually not the graph, it's on page 52 of the report. We're focusing on a solutions-based coverage, whereas I'm talking about the reality of what happens every single day in Palestine. That is not being reported, right? Even when we're talking about Israel-Palestine, we get into the debate of one state or two state and so on and so forth. We're still talking about something abstract. I'm talking about journalists doing their job and covering what's going on the ground. And the reason I wanted to share this particular graph from the Institute for Democracy in Israel is because it shows Israelis' trust in their state institutions and the various institutions of government and the public. And we see that the media is quite low on the list, low, much lower below the army, the government, various parliaments, police, and so on. Now, this is not by accident. This has been the work, a very meticulous work of Prime Minister Netanyahu and before him. Many, many different reasons contributed to this. Thank you very much for this graph, Iman. But you in America have had a similar kind of attack on the press. And, you know, I entered this profession long before Trump. I've seen that even when there isn't an attack on the press, they were not doing that job. They were not reporting on the reality in Israel and Palestine. And now that added to that is this massive coordinated attack on the media. I was wondering if you can talk about these two forces and how they contribute to coverage in the U.S. of Israel and Palestine.
Well, Leah, first I'd ask you, you see that we're looking at that 36% trust number in Israel. I guess it's Israel.
Yep, in Israel.
And remarkably, both Palestinians and Jews inside Israel seem to share that 36%. What do you imagine that number is in the United States? I'm curious.
I mean, I think in the U.S. it's probably very similar, but it's probably divided between Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's true. From my standpoint, I think that the media reflect here as to the question of what is actually going on in Palestine versus this discussion of solutions and two states, three states, you know, one state. The media here are reflecting the fact that this is this giant, intractable problem. That's the way Americans look at Israel and Palestine, a giant problem. And Israel is the answer to the Holocaust. That is sort of the simple answer that I think a lot of politicians have here, and that the media have too, and that therefore they do not want to overturn this paradigm of the two-state solution of a Jewish state alongside a Palestinian state. And so the reality, they will occasionally report atrocities from occupied territories, of which there are countless atrocities. I mean, that's part of my job, unfortunately, as I say. I mean, the same time that George Floyd is killed in Minneapolis, a learning disabled young Palestinian is shot to death by police, hunted down and shot outside his school because he misunderstands inside occupied territories, because he doesn't understand what the police are saying. And that case has been, there have been several other cases like that in months since, and they don't get reported in the United States. And that's a pity. And even when they do get reported, it's never reported in terms of this sort of systematic abuse and repression of Palestinian rights. Palestinians have no rights in the occupied territories, and they have limited rights inside Israel. I think that it's very hard for people to reflect this reality because, again, here it does reflect America's myths about itself, in that we have, the United States has a mythology about itself that's a very idealistic and romantic mythology about being a great democracy. And, you know, I grew up with that. I partake of it. I could espouse some of that myself. But it's related to the Israel situation, in that there's a mythology about Israel as a robust democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East. And Americans have largely accepted that. And they feel that because of the Holocaust background and because of the effect of the Israel lobby inside American politics, they feel that if they somehow remove the Jewish state or delegitimize the Jewish state, that there would be chaos and Jews would be pushed into the sea and slaughtered in Israel. I think that that is actually the fear and belief that exists among politicians, even ones who have been over there. They have been indoctrinated. They think that as Sheldon Adelson said, the Muslims just want to kill all the Jews. Is that responsive to your question, Leah?
I want to get on to it.
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So I'd like to talk a little bit about where you the contradictory tendencies you see in American Jewish society. Surveys show that Canadian Jewish society is much more conservative in general than American society. Canadian Jews go to Israel more. They spend more time there. They feel their identity is more, this is survey data, their identity is more linked with Israel than America. Our impression here is that in America, the divisions are greater, that there are more and more acute contradictions amongst American Jews. And it's hard for us to get a sense of which way that's going. So on the one hand, you have the AIPAC and all that stuff. On the other hand, you have a Jewish Voice for Peace. And then in the middle, maybe this not be fair, you have the Peter Beinart kind of phenomenon. Can you give us your read of what are the contradictory currents in American Jewish society, and which way it's trending based on what you see?
Certainly. I think that we should begin by stating that traditionally the American Jewish community as an organized entity, and this is not talking about dinner table conversations or argument with the son or the, you know, as an organized community, the American Jewish community has been monolithic in support of Israel for a long time. And that is the headline that really needs to be acknowledged. I don't think it's that different from Canada in that respect. And so I can look over at my shelf right now and I see a book from the 1970s about the American Jewish community and relationship with Israel. We are one, with an exclamation point, with no irony. That professor of Jewish studies, Melvin Yurovsky, would have said that with triumph. We are one. American Jews, Israeli Jews, we stand behind Israel as a Jewish state. So when you, so today, when one speaks of the organ, now that has begun to change since the 70s. We are one reflected that those wars that Israel had reflected Holocaust consciousness in American life and in Jewish life of the 70s was a generation and more ago. Today, the organized Jewish community is still lock, stock, and barrel for Israel, with some tiny exceptions. And you will find if at a major synagogue on a forum on U.S. Israel, a Jewish relationship with Israel, you'll have young liberal Zionists stand up and say 95% of American Jews are for Israel, support Israel. And I think that they are correct about that, that 95% of American Jews support Israel. Now, what the notable differences and the notable trend involves the fact that people like myself, who are feel some historical distance from the Holocaust and who are very involved in an American struggle for civil rights, have brought those lessons to the Israel-Palestine question, have been to Israel and Palestine, and are questioning the idea of a Jewish state. And I would say that it's 5%, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 15%. But there is a real erosion at the edge of the Jewish community around these questions. And I would say that here, the great scholar of Zionism, I'd go to the great scholar of Zionism, Ernest Hemingway, who in, you know, The Sun Also Rises, when the characters ask, how do you go bankrupt? You know, well, it was gradual and then it was sudden. So I feel like that type of trend, I'm very hopeful about this trend, but I feel that we are seeing a trend inside the Jewish community that that 95% consensus that I just described is really atherosclerotic. It's an older generation. I'm old, as I said. I said at the start, I want to emphasize, my ageism includes prejudice against myself here. But they're old. They're just wed to this old paradigm. And they just, the young kids are just not down for it. It's the dead hand of the past in that they're the donor class. They're the chairman and CEO class of these organizations. But when you say AIPAC, it's just AIPAC. No, the Conference of Presidents, which is AIPAC, which is constituted in part by Americans for Peace Now, a liberal Zionist organization, they're all for Israel. And yet at the edge, you begin to see this real questioning. And the questioning is happening because people have met Israelis like Leah, you know, or they've gone over and toured with people like Leah. And they've seen that it's worse than Jim Crow. It's apartheid. And so that consciousness is breaking in among young Jews who don't feel that saying these things is going to cause, you know, Auschwitz to reemerge on the landscape. Okay. I'm sorry if I went on too long, but that's the beginning of an answer to a very difficult question.
What about the, is there such a thing as a Peter Beinart phenomenon? He gets in the New York Times. Can you talk a bit about that, importance of that? Is it significant?
Yeah, Peter Beinart is a very important figure in American Jewish life. for those who don't know, Peter is, I guess he's pushing 50. He is an observant Jew who really cares about the opinion of his parents, unlike myself, and I think Leah too, I can include in that. Peter used to speak at AIPAC events. He was very pro-Israel. He's always been pro-Israel. And today he has called for the end of a Jewish state. So you see a very, I think, a very brave and courageous struggle on his part. He's not where I am on this. I wish he would go further. I wish he would support BDS, which is the only appropriate response to the human rights abuses that are taking place. But he's made this journey. And he has been embraced at times by liberal Zionists because part of his journey was saying, no, Palestinians shouldn't have equal rights to Jews. There should be a Jewish state. and let's have a two-state solution and just let the Palestinians have their state. And he's moved on to say that's absurd. You can't separate these two populations. There are too many settlers. Just a lot of the stuff I've said. He said this has all happened in the course of 10 years or so. So you've gotten to see this very public transformation of a leading intellectual. And to your question, I think there are many Jews like Peter Beiner. And when he was a liberal Zionist, they used to have these, you go to these liberal Zionist conferences and they'd have T-shirts saying, because he was critical of Israel, but loved Israel. They loved that. So he had T-shirts, Beinart's Army, you know, where the young people really wanted to have a charismatic person who was supporting equal rights supporting human rights rather than these slaughters that Israel was doing in 2009 and 2014. Peter Beinart was this alternate reality for them. Well, Peter Beinart has now abandoned those organizations, left them high and dry, and to answer your question, this, I think it is a trend, and you're going to see more and more Jews following in this course.
So I think that one of the other things that is a huge difference between the generations is that my generation and younger have kind of seen the limitations of the soccer game approach to discussing Israel and Palestine, in the sense of, like, even the way that you put, you know, they support Israel, they don't support Israel. When they do these surveys, it's not clear what that means. I mean, I'm an Israeli, I support Israel. Yeah. Do I support an apartheid system of law? Of course not. Do I support, you know, equal rights to everyone who lives in the territory? Of course I do. But these soccer game analogies of, like, we are the right ones, they are the wrong ones, that have infiltrated also the left for so long and have led to a complete miscommunication and an abandonment of values, I think those are changing. And another thing that is a very big change, not just the understanding of the complexity of the situation and the simplicity of the situation, but also that, you know, my generation of Jews who are in the diaspora and also in Israel, when that hegemony that the institutions, the Jewish institutions have held, whether it's the central rabbinate in Israel, the chief rabbinate, or UJA here in Canada, or APAC in the US, they've had a monolith over what it means to be Jewish. Jewish means to support the Israelis, meaning Israeli government, meaning Israeli army, a very, very kind of blanket, hands-off support that didn't really go into details of what it means. When that hegemony was broken, a lot of Jewish people, especially my age and younger, have rediscovered their Jewishness and have given themselves the permission to explore their Jewishness in a way that's separate from Israel and from the institutions. And I think that that is a huge revolution. It's a huge liberation for Jewishness in our community, because once we stop identifying our Jewishness with Israel only, we are free to reconnect with our 4,000-year civilization and everything that that means, including, of course, justice and human rights, which we have a very long history of that. And so I was wondering if you're seeing that as well.
Well, Leah, I'm curious. I want you to tell me, how large a group is that? How when you say
everywhere I go, it seems that it's just burning like fire everywhere. Like, I run a Jewish school here in Toronto. I didn't think that I would ever be in a situation where I would be in Jewish education. Wow. And yet, it's everywhere I look. People come up to us and they're like, listen, I grew up in a very pro-Israel family, very conservative, was never allowed to speak my mind. But then I discovered that I have a lot of Jewish connection to my heritage, but it's got nothing to do with Israel. Where can I go? And I think that that is a bypass that is very invisible. And it's becoming not just a river, but a real torrent of young families who don't want to raise their children on Israeli militarism and don't want to raise their children on a very conservative, hegemonic understanding of Jewishness and a very patriarchal and queer phobic understanding of Jewishness. And because they are separating themselves from that hegemony on all of the social, cultural, religious, and spiritual questions, they're also inherently separating themselves on the political questions. Mm. And that's an incredible thing to watch. It's not so much in Israel, but in diaspora, I'm seeing that, you know, spreading. And I was wondering whether you're seeing that as well with your readership, whether you're seeing more demand for Jewish content that's not based on Israel.
I think the answer is yes. But I also feel that I am not a good informant on these questions, and that you are, And so I'm more interested in what you have to say about it than I do. I certainly am aware that...
What a journalist move.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a little bit sincere too.
Just a little bit.
So, I'm curious. So Leah, I mean, certainly would you, you know, there is in the United States this organization, If Not Now. And I don't know how many people are familiar with it, but this is young Jews who were typically raised in a very religiously affiliated background, and who are now in their 20s and who strongly rejected the Zionism. Not completely, but they didn't want to be force-fed love of Israel. And
you know what's amazing about If Not Now is that they only have one goal. They're also here in Canada. And their goal is not ending apartheid in Israel or two-state or one-state. Their number one goal is ending Jewish institutional support for the occupation. So they finally understood that as Americans, their job is not to meddle in Israel and Palestine, but to get American support out of the American foundation that holds up the occupation. And if they just succeed to do that, they would end up leading to peace and justice in Israel and Palestine more than anything else they could do. And the same thing here in Canada. Yeah.
That's a very good point. And I should say they began in 2014. And so what you're saying is that they identified this root cause among the root causes, the one root cause for which they could have some ownership and responsibility was the American Jewish establishment. Okay.
And its support for Israel's occupation.
They have failed at that. And they're working hard at it. I accept that.
Define success?
I define success as making progress. And I don't see progress in the American Jewish establishment. And I think that it's a mistake to put all your eggs in that basket. I think that you have to organize. I think they're doing good work. But I think they're young people, and I think they don't have a clear program. They don't address apartheid. They retweet, you know, there's a discussion of apartheid that is happening around the world now about Israel. And it's a very important discussion, and it's been greatly advanced this week by an Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, which says this is apartheid from the river to the sea. And American Jews who want to be part of this struggle, in my opinion, have to be endorsing that because it's true and have to be adding their voices to that. So to narrow focus and then say, no, all we're doing is focused on getting the American Jewish establishment not to support the occupation is a type of blindness, because it's not just the occupation. It goes beyond the occupation. And I like what If Not Now is done, but I don't want to get into, I think we're getting into the weeds, but I brought them up more to say that, was responsive to your point, their name comes out of one of the most beautiful quotes in Jewish tradition, which is Rabbi Hillel says, if I'm only for myself, then who am I for? If I'm not, if I'm...
If nobody does for me, then who will do for me?
Yeah. And if not now, when? I mean, I'm butchering the quote, but it's a wonderful statement of the sort of ethical problem that all individuals face in the world. And so part of when they said, if not now, they were saying, hey, we're against the occupation. If not now, when? And that was, they came up with this in 2014 when Israel had slaughtered 2,200 people in Gaza, including 500 children. A wonderful response by them to this of young Jewish people. And I think that it speaks to Leah's point, which I'm not in that community to the extent that she is, or I'm not observing it. And Leah's a different generation than I am. So they are very Jewishly identified young people who are taking Jewish traditions and employing them toward justice. So, but you, again, I emphasize, you know more about this than I do, Leah. So it's an imposture on my part to
just, Not that Leah's questions are great, and I can see her doing the whole thing, but I have a list here of things, a couple of things I want to talk to you about. Before I do, someone has mentioned that IGV Canada done a survey of Canadian Jews that showed that our Canadian Jewish community is quite divided. I don't know whether it spoke to its support for Zionism. I think, but it certainly had divided opinions about the occupation and those kinds of issues. Phil, I wanted to raise your question here from Canada on the importance of anti-Semitism as a phenomenon in the United States and how that's impacting the Jewish community. It seems to me to be obvious that every time we have an anti-Semitic act, that stirs the Zionist kind of nerve. I mean, people feel, I'm sure, feel frightened. I don't have a sense of whether in the States today, whether the anti-Semitism is as big as the anti-Black phenomenon, how significant it is, what's it doing to the American Jewish community in terms of its attitudes towards Israel?
Well, before addressing the Israel piece, I should say that anti-Semitism has certainly reared its ugly head in the United States in the last few years in the Trump era. And one of the reasons that tonight and tomorrow are joyful days in the United States is that many Americans are hopeful that under Biden and Harris, there will be a new era in the United States, and that Trumpism, if it doesn't go away, it won't go away with a wave of a wand, but the Trumpism will begin to ebb from the public space. So anti-Semitism has been a prominent feature of Trumpism. I do not think it approaches the level of hatred and threat that Muslims and African Americans have felt, but certainly there have been massacres in Poway and in Pittsburgh, San Diego, the Poway in San Diego. In those cases, those were massacres. And there have been a lot of threats against Jews, and there's been a lot of anti-Semitic messaging in the last few years. So we have undoubtedly seen a recrudescence of anti-Semitism in a way that people like myself, who were saying years ago, anti-Semitism is no longer a factor in American public life, I was wrong. It still is an important, I wouldn't say major factor, but it's an important element of the American social mix, and it's a very scary one. Mm. That being said, it is also manipulated by Zionists to try to foster support for Israel, including saying that left-wing anti-Semitism is as bad as right-wing anti-Semitism. Right-wing anti-Semitism, which killed, I think, 11 people, was it, at Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, that's killing 11 people is the same as joining a Students for Justice in Palestine chapter at a university. That's left-wing. So this is a completely bogus argument. Left-wing anti-Semitism, I certainly have seen some very virulently anti-Israel comments on the left. I've occasionally seen that blur into blaming Jews, and talk about Jewish identity, talk about essential Jewish name. I mean, I've seen that in anti-Zionism, no doubt, but at the periphery. So I think it's a very confusing period. And I think that one of the great things about Biden coming in is that for the last few years, left-wingers like myself have been very involved with liberal Zionists in a joint struggle to get rid of Trump. And we sort of said, hey, I will put aside my differences over the Jewish state in order to deal with this threat to the American state. And so now that threat is an immediate threat of Donald Trump in the White House, as of tomorrow, will be gone, champagne, you know, hallelujah. And we can begin to focus on the ways that the liberal Zionists are misrepresenting reality, misrepresenting apartheid in across the sea.
Yeah. Okay.
I wanted to follow up on our conversation about the press, since your primary role in Mandelweiss is being a journalist. I found it very interesting after I worked in Israel-Palestine for a bunch of years as a journalist and did all this stuff. And then I made the film and I took the film on tour and I went on 20 countries and I spoke to activists in all these different places. And I found that there was this opposite effect. So while I became a journalist because I saw that there was a chronic, bewildering lack of coverage of Israel and Palestine beyond the talking points in the mainstream press, what I saw when I went on tour and spoke to activists all over the world, it's that they go to Mandelweiss, they go to the real news, they go to Electronic Intifada, and of course, 972 magazine. And that's only thing that they read. And in there, and so there's an opposite kind of matching effect of hyperinflation of certain voices and certain understandings that, first of all, is decontextualized from the region. Secondly, decontextualized from history. And thirdly, feeds back into this soccer match politics. And I was wondering whether you see the same thing, or maybe that's just something that I observed. And secondly, if you do, what do you see is a way for us to find an intelligent, analytical, dialectical medium where we're actually thinking through the ever-evolving problems rather than using the same mold to see the reality as it is unfolding?
So, Leah, I feel that's a tall order, what you laid out. It reflects your the size. You have a big brain, and your I don't want to hold a brief for journalism because journalism changes. But when you say soccer match, it's very similar to coverage of politics that's called a horse race. They say, why are you covering politics like a horse race? You know, journalists have that very superficial element to their approach. So when you use the word dialectical about your expectation, your hopes for journalistic, what they can produce, I don't know if they're ultimately going to be sad. I feel that ultimately you are going to be engaged with more analytical thinkers who will certainly be engaged with journalism. So that's where I think journalism is changing so much, though, all the time, that I hesitate to say that superficiality is, you know, going to characterize all. I don't know. I mean, but to your point about the decontextualized and place that people go to among activists. Yeah, I think that, from my standpoint, I think there's been a shattering because of the internet. It's shattered everything. And there's been great stuff that's come out of that. But part of what comes out of that is things like Parler, you know, where, and alternative facts, where these crazy right-wingers went and they were in their own community and they fed each other their own information. I don't mean to analogize the left-wing discussion to that completely decontextualized discussion, but there are certainly elements in the left where we're talking among ourselves. And, you know, certainly if you go to the left and people who are reading Electronic Intifada and 972, they have a rich understanding of what's going on over there. And sometimes that is detached from reality in that they're not aware of, or they're not fully cognizant of the fact that huge percentages of the Israeli public would never contemplate, you know, has no idea of what justice means. And even in the Palestinian public, according to opinion polls, there's large percentages that still want a Palestinian state. And certainly in the American political class, everyone is for a two-state solution. So I feel like these realities have to merge at some point before there's going to be an honest discussion of this. And I mean, to go back to the events that are happening in the discourse right now and to the B'Tselem report, I referenced this earlier, this human rights organization from Israel said there's apartheid in from the river to the sea. And it's an apartheid regime because there's apartheid in the West Bank that it enforces. And the London Review of Books this week said, no, it's apartheid from the river to the sea because there's discrimination against Palestinians inside Israel. And Yesh Din, an Israeli human rights organization, said last summer, it's apartheid. And Palestinian organizations have been saying it's apartheid. So this discussion that happened in South Africa on the left among activists is happening now in a very, it's always been happening, but now it is really gaining traction. And today, Human Rights Watch even retweeted the report from the London Review of Books saying it's from the river to the sea. So you see, even Human Rights Watch engaging this discussion. I feel like this is one way that the left can, the model for the left is that we have this discussion that feels like it's isolated and that we're all talking among ourselves, but that we break through. And that, I think, is the model. I've been going all over the plot with your question, Leah. I'm sorry if that's not fully responsive.
But to your point and to Leah's point, I did a blog post this week on the B'Tselem report and so on, talking about, is it fair to call Israel an apartheid state? And I had lots of people write in and say, well, the debate's over. The debate's over for people like Leah and me and Phil, but it's not over for the great mass of Canadians, for sure. And we have to find a way to carry that debate forward. It's a bit of a narrowing vision of the world to say, well, the debate's now over.
It is, but I mean, I think that the reality that these people reflect when they say that is one that, I mean, I can remember traveling through Kalandia checkpoint with Leah. You know, when you're there, the debate's over. I'm sorry. I don't so that's why they say this, that this reality is so enormous, that the enormity of the abuse is so profound and oceanic and inarguable that you are shocked that there would be a debate about this in the United States. And what
But the point is it.
But
most
I accept
people,
your point. I take
most people
point.
Still don't agree with
of course,
us. I mean,
of course, of course. And what was important to me about this London Review of Books article saying "River to the Sea" is that it says, "What's the firewall to this understanding?" The firewall is liberal Zionist organizations that have been there and they know it, but they can't let this awareness creep in over here. So there's a real struggle now with liberal Zionists. And that's part of my, you saw my anger rise about, if not now, you know, for people who know, for people who've been there, this is a which side are you on question.
Mm-hmm. Right. But on the left, when there's usually a much harder criticism for the person right next to you than for the gaping mass of the mainstream. But speaking of the mainstream, I don't know if you've seen, there was a very important poll done by ECOS, which is a big polling company in Canada. And they asked the question of whether Canadians would support the International Criminal Court prosecuting Israeli war crimes. And the overwhelming majority of Canadians supported. So,
wow, really?
Another question about boycott. A couple of years ago, there was another poll done also by ECOS. They found that there was a growing support for among regular Canadians for the boycott and divestment and sanctions movement, or at the very least for the concept of boycott in order to reach peace. And in terms of generic kind of soccer game, do you support Israel or Palestine? They were almost identical numbers amongst Canadians. So whoever it is that's doing the work,
what do you take away from that, Leah? What's your... How does that affect your understanding of politics in Canada?
Well, what I take from that personally, it's that there's a very big difference between politics in Canada and politics in America. Israel is very similar to America in the sense that Israelis are very political people. We're always reading the press, the news. Every bus is always playing the news radio in the background. There's the news on every screen in every coffee shop. We're very political people, and everyone has an opinion. And if you sit down with Israelis and you don't use antagonizing language, you will find that you will find a lot more in common than you think. And with Canadians, Canadians are much more similar to a very kind of conservative shade of British, in the sense that the discussion of politics is considered quite taboo. And anything that's contentious inside of politics is triply taboo. So what I found when I was touring the US, for example, is when I said that I was a journalist covering Israel and Palestine, people would either tell me their opinion or they would ask me questions. Whereas here, their face would become flush and they would do anything to avoid the conversation. So that's one thing. But another thing, I think it's that the Canadian press, as critical as much as it deserves criticism for certain things, has been doing a much better job than the American press in covering what actually goes on. Obviously, not nearly as much as it should. But I also think that there isn't as big of an awareness amongst Canadians of amongst white Canadians of their role in the oppression of people of color, in their role in stopping Jews from coming here who are trying to escape the Holocaust. They're not taking as much responsibility for Canadian roles in slavery, Canadian roles in Indigenous genocide, Canadian roles in propping up white supremacy. So there isn't a constant questioning of whether I have a responsibility as a white Canadian towards something.
When you said they're not taking as much responsibility, are you comparing in that light? Are you saying that United States Americans are doing better at that?
There's at the very least a conversation.
I see.
You have been listening to a conversation with Mondo Weiss founder Phil Weiss and journalist and filmmaker Leah Tarachansky. Before leaving, I want to give a shout out to the Mondo Weiss News Service, which brings to its followers important news and updates from Palestine every day. If you do not receive its online reports, we encourage you to do so. It runs on our donations, and it is well worth reading and supporting. Check it out at mondoweiss.net. That's mondoweiss.net. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم